I think we can all agree that nobody wants to see pastors carted off in handcuffs and, you know, bring the van and load up all the pews and shovel them in the paddy wagon.
Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith, freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm General Counsel Holly Holman. This week, we'll talk about some of the recent litigation over bans on mass gatherings that include religious services and how courts are coming down in a variety of these cases.
And in our final segment, we'll talk about how we are seeing religion respected in what we're reading and listening to during this continued time of social distancing.
Hi, Amanda. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
As we remain here in the DMV, as we like to call it, the District, Maryland, Virginia area, to continue to do almost everything at home, doing everything we can to stay home, including our BJC work.
Yeah, I had a friend who had a 40 days in quarantine party for their family. Didn't invite anybody else. It was just their family. But they baked a cake and everything. And I thought, has it already been 40 days?
Wow. Following at least the district's guidelines, we can at least count on 4 more weeks. But I think we do that knowing that we're thinking in chunks of time and not complete ending of the situation.
That's right. And we are starting to see, you know, just to give our listeners a context of when we're having this conversation, around the country, we're starting to see resistance to these stay-at-home orders with some protests, again, you know, relatively small protests, but certainly those that are in excess of the social distancing guidelines that are popping up across the country. And we know, though, that this isn't still a minority position, that for the most part, Americans are more concerned about opening up the country too soon than in having too many closures right now. We're having some societal angst about the closures that is popping up in different ways.
We are, and it's likely to continue as we get mixed messages from our political leaders and see kind of conflicts between federal and state and local authorities, a lack of coordination, although we've seen some effort to try to work on that. And hopefully they will continue to work on that because we know that most people are trying to be helpful and we're trying to get things right. And as we talk today about some of these conflicts in religious communities, we know that the vast majority of Americans have adapted and are trying to adapt to really follow that federal guidance that says we've got to be careful and stem the spread of the virus so that we can get through this.
So today on Respecting Religion, we are going to, you know, kind of focus in on some of the legal disputes that have been popping up when it comes to these restrictions on mass gatherings and directives for social distancing and to stay at home as much as possible, you know, what impact that has on religious organizations. And before we get into that conversation in more detail, I feel like this is a disclaimer, but it's important to keep repeating this, that the vast majority of houses of worship and religious individuals are heeding the directives and the guidance and common sense, and they're showing love for their neighbor by not engaging in risky behaviors, which includes gathering in large crowds of people. And we've said that intuitively. We've said that because we are religious people. We go to church. We haven't been in our sanctuaries for weeks.
We've witnessed it firsthand that that's how people are responding.
Yeah. But we now have some data to back that up, actually. PRRI put out a poll. And according to their poll, about 8% of Americans said that their houses of worship are still holding services. And only, I think, 3% of the respondents said that they were actually going to in-person services. And then the Washington Post put out a story where they used cell phones for tracking and had a map that compared how people moved on Sunday mornings, people go to church from last year to this year, and showed a dramatic drop off in church attendance. So just some interesting data points that kind of I think, shore up what we all have been saying and thinking about what most people are doing when it comes to religious observance right now.
Yeah, we want to be fair as we talk about religious entities. And I think that's important to recognize. By focusing on these cases, we're not trying to give them undue importance in reflection of religion in America, because that would be wrong. But we want to note that. And also, as we talk about this, this is our Respecting Religion podcast, where we are talking about religious liberty issues in the world and bringing BJC's 80 years of experience to these discussions. And it is taken away from their primary story about the coronavirus, which is the seriousness of it. And the fact that we are still watching rising numbers, we're still seeing the awful, you know, hospital stories. And as we talk about these disputes in religious communities, we have to be aware that that's affect churches too. And we've seen some high profile stories of outbreaks in religious communities and the effect on church staff and church members in this crisis. So we're very aware of that as we talk about these practical legal disputes.
Yeah, I think the sobering piece of data that hit me in looking at news this week is that in recent period, there were more people who died of coronavirus in a day than who died of heart disease or of cancer. Yeah. And so the toll on human life is immense right now. And added to that is just how little we know about this virus, about how it spreads and how it impacts, and about why certain people die and others don't. And just to, I guess, lift up a couple of stories that we've seen about how that can happen tragically in houses of worship as well. Several weeks ago, there was news out of the state of Washington, Mount Vernon, Washington, and Mount Vernon Presbyterian Church, a choir, where a number of people in the choir contracted the virus and died. And then also a tragic story out of Richmond, Virginia, Bishop Gerald Glenn, the pastor of New Deliverance Evangelistic Church. And, you know, he was someone who had held a service even after there were directives and guidance to stay at home. And then he contracted the virus and died. And other members of his family have also contracted the virus. So just to pause and reflect about that, this is a life and death matter that we're talking about.
I think that both of those stories, and they're just two among many, will come to mind, or stories like that will come to mind for our listeners as they think about these church disputes. Because, you know, if you're arguing vigorously that you need more gatherings, or you think the government's being too harsh on you and you really want your church to open, you probably aren't thinking about the choir where a majority of the people got sick, or a funeral where a large percentage got infected. But, you know, we have enough news stories, access to news stories, to know that that should be top of mind.
So with that top of mind, we also are going to talk here about what's going on in the courts and in litigation in some of these cases that we've seen. And when we've talked about this on a previous episode in general, right, some of the legal disputes, and when the question was first being raised, oh, is this violate religious freedom? And one of our first responses was, well, you'll have to see what the facts of the case are. What are the facts? And we'll have to wait and see. We have cases. Well, now we have some cases.
We do. A growing number of cases.
Yeah. But before we get into the cases, I thought we'd love our listeners to go back and listen to a prior episode, but to save you a little time here, we'll recap some of the main principles. Holly, do you want to remind us what some of the main principles we should be keeping in mind?
Sure.
Big picture as we think through these cases.
Yeah, if people just kind of generally heard their religious liberty issues coming out of government orders that affect churches, it brings to mind some kind of fundamental first questions. And I think we would say that first thing to think about is that, of course, restricting worship, restricting church gatherings, houses of worship gatherings, is a burden on religious exercise. Religious freedom in our country is fundamental. It's a fundamental liberty that is always given due consideration. You know, if government imposes a rule on religious exercise like gathering, it's a burden on religious liberty, and we try to avoid that for constitutional and policy reasons. So there is a burden on religious exercise, but the second important principle to understand is that government can restrict free exercise of religion, especially for what are known as compelling governmental interest. And the classic compelling governmental interest is health and safety. So religious liberty is not some guarantee for always getting special treatment. States have broad police powers to make sure that the government can protect the health and safety of its citizens. And that clearly comes into play in what we're going through now. Then the third principle to keep in mind is that while the government has, and particularly states and local government have these broad police powers, they can't target religion or single religious gatherings out for special disfavor. Generally, religion should be treated in a fair way, in a way that is not singled out for any kind of disfavor. So in these situations, we want to make sure that religion is treated at least as good as its secular counterparts.
And so thank you for that recap. And I think with those three main principles in mind, we've been following these cases as they've been popping up around the country and seeing how these principles are at work in very local, you know, circumstances, because that's the way that these stay-at-home orders and bans on mass gatherings are operating. They're operating in terms of local communities, and those vary from place to place. And so we've seen some churches that are starting to challenge them. They base those challenges on constitutional provisions and sometimes in state laws that offer further protection for religious freedom. And some cases are coming out for the churches, others are coming out on behalf of the state. And so we thought it would be useful to have a quick review of some of those cases, but also see some of the themes that we see emerging from the lot growing sample size, I guess, we have of opinions here.
We do. It's still kind of early in the resolution of these cases, but we've seen enough just in the last week that we can talk about a few aspects in our conversation today that could be helpful.
So we'll start our tour in Kentucky because we've had a couple of cases come out of Kentucky. And as we talk today, we're going to kind of pull out some of these themes or aspects of the cases that we think might be useful to listeners as we evaluate future cases that might be coming out, or as we think about how these disputes might evolve as restrictions are eased in some way or change in some way across the country. And I think the first aspect to point out is what a patchwork approach to limiting human interaction right now we have at play. And sometimes that patchwork doesn't vary just between states, but even within a state. And that's what we had in Kentucky, where Governor Beshear in Kentucky had a series of executive orders, but Mayor Fisher in Louisville had an even more restrictive order for that urban community. And so there are two cases that have come out of Kentucky, one brought by On Fire Christian Center, and another brought by the Maryville Baptist Church. And they came out in different ways. And that's maybe in part because they were dealing with different restrictions in those two cases.
I think that's right. And the way the Kentucky cases have unfolded show that patchwork and some conflict between governor's orders and local government officials' orders that might be more restrictive, maybe for good reason, because they're in a more densely populated area. And it makes sense that it takes a while to work through these cases and to resolve any perceived or actual conflicts with these different orders.
Yeah. And a couple of threshold things too in Kentucky. One, as I mentioned, one of the cases was brought by a Baptist church. We at BJC are very familiar with Baptist churches. We are the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, and have long been associated with a number of different Baptist denominations and churches and individuals. So just a very quick Baptist 101 for people who might be learning about Baptists through our podcast in some way, that as many Baptists as there are that many different ways to consider yourself to be a Baptist. There are, I like to cite a Pew study that estimated about 15% of Americans consider themselves to be Baptist, and they identified 16 different ways of being Baptist in that poll. So we at BJC do not speak for Baptists. We couldn't if we tried, but one aspect of being Baptist is the sense of local control and primacy of the local church. And so I think it is natural that we're seeing Baptists interpreting these stay-at-home orders and making decisions in different ways, that they're not looking to some higher church authority to give them direction on whether to stay open or not.
That's right. And BJC's authority comes from our 80 years as religious liberty experts, as those who we do call on our Baptist heritage that any Baptist across the spectrum could look up in the history books, just know that Baptists have long been known for their fight for religious freedom. So at least at the beginning of our country's founding, that was the impact of Baptists, well, an impact of Baptists prior to that, was this commitment to religious liberty for all. So BJC stands in that vein of Baptist life, but our churches are very diverse. And we come to this analysis and conversation today, both as lawyers in Baptist life, serving Baptists and others who maintain that strong commitment to religious freedom for all. But as you know, Amanda, it is a diverse lot for sure in the way Baptists are organized democratically and from the congregational level, as opposed to other religious traditions that have more uniformity because they are top down. They respond to larger denominational entities that kind of dictate what they believe and how they respond to things. And with that, let's take a break and then come back and talk a little bit more about what we can learn from these recent cases. Okay, we're back. And one of the things that we should talk about next is sort of related to this patchwork of orders that have to be reconciled and interpreted, is that there's not much time. We're seeing legal disputes, basically people rushing to court because they're concerned that an order is going to take an immediate effect, that it is going to require them to stop something that was planned, in some cases planned to happen the next day or in 5 days, and that is to have these important religious gatherings.
Yeah, and we saw that in the Kentucky cases. So the On Fire case, which it's just kind of fun to say. But in that case, the Louisville mayor's order came out a few days before Easter Sunday. Probably the highest church attendance all year happens on Easter Sunday. And so the plaintiffs in that case, they rushed to the courthouse before Easter Sunday and asked for emergency relief for the mayor's order not to go into effect. And the order in that case was that the church there wanted to hold their service as a drive-in service.
Yeah, but Amanda, first, before we talk about the drive-ins, I mean, the concern is they're thinking, am I going to go to jail because I'm going to church? I mean, really, yeah. they're thinking about enforcement. What? Are you telling me the government is going to fine me? And that's the sort of immediate specter of horror that comes to mind when they talk about enforcing this. And, you know, we've been in this for several weeks now, but still the idea that we are really trapped at home or that we really our freedom has to be so restricted is really hard for people. I think we could all agree that nobody wants to see pastors carted off in handcuffs and, you know, bring the van and load up all the congregants to get them out of the pews and shovel them in the paddy wagon.
Yeah, so that offends our sensibilities to think about that happening, to state the obvious, right?
It does. And so you have these cases quickly going to court to clarify and get the clear instruction about what's necessary going forward. And then you were saying that was particularly the case in the early Kentucky case that came out of a drive-in situation?
Yeah. So the, again, there are different rules in effect in Kentucky, but in Louisville, the mayor initially had said, not only could church communities not gather in the sanctuary, in the church building to worship, but there have been some creative services going on in the church parking lot where people would pull up in their car and leave their windows up, or in some cases just barely crack their windows, but observe social distancing in that way.
And so the question is whether when they have a ban on mass gatherings, does that include a gathering of vehicles? Is that right?
That's right. And so in Louisville, the mayor had been explicit in his case that it would include a ban on the cars in the parking lot. And so that's when the church filed for legal relief to be able to meet. And in that case, the judge put out an opinion before Easter Sunday and allowed them to go ahead and go through with their church service. In the other case, and I will say, you know, this idea of the threat of some kind of criminal enforcement played heavy in the judge's opinion as well. In the other case from Kentucky, it involved a church that had met on Easter Sunday in the church sanctuary against the governor's order to do so. And while they were there, the Kentucky State Police came to the parking lot and started issuing citations to the cars parked in the parking lot that they were in violation of the governor's order by being at church on Sunday. And so they went to court and asked for emergency relief so that they could continue to do so. So they would know they wouldn't have to pay the fines and that they would be able to continue on their way and meet again. And the judge in that case ruled with the governor and said no, that the governor was able to have his ban on mass gatherings. That did not violate religious freedom in that way.
Well, so, one way, I guess, to very quickly for our purposes talk about those two cases is that the state may be able to accommodate and allow car gatherings. They don't have to be treated exactly like other mass gatherings where people are in each other's airspace, but that it's a much different story to say you just get an exemption from the mass gathering ban and say, just because we're a church and because it's really important to us, we want to continue to meet together and we deserve an exemption.
That's right. And I think we're seeing, to the extent that we can start to draw some conclusions from the limited number of cases that we have coming down, I would say we're seeing you are more likely to win your case if you're meeting in a drive-in situation than if you're going into the church for your service.
I have to say, these cases really did surprise me in that we have all this talk about drive-ins. I mean, it's not unusual for BJC to learn about all different kinds of religious expressions, right? We see them in the cases. Our friends call us and tell us about them as they read them. But who knew that drive-ins, whether the kind where they're sort of makeshift drive-ins in church parking lots where people are just parking near each other, or actually trying to convert the old drive-in movie theaters into worship spaces. Who knew that would happen? But I would note that as I was trying to learn more about this, I learned that I think just this week there's a new story about drive-in movie theaters kind of maybe being the first to be reopened when we start opening things up for entertainment, you know. And again, it's a unique way of doing a mass gathering. I also just learned that there happens to be a driveinmovie.com where you can find out all kinds of fun facts about drive-in movies. There are more of them still in existence today than you would think.
A website for everything, right? An association for everything. I do think, and you know, the drive-in movie example is a good one because, to my knowledge, I don't know of any drive-in movies that are exempt right now from general closure of mass gatherings, right? That those, when we're talking about the reopening of drive-in movie theaters as movie theaters, we're talking about the next phase of opening up our society again. And part of that is because consumers are not going to feel comfortable walking into a movie theater and sitting elbow to elbow with people who might be infected. That it is as much for the consumer's willingness to go out into the open marketplace as it is obviously also for health and safety. So we were talking about the apples to apples comparison. I want to make clear, I don't know of drive-in movie theaters that are open right now. We do know of some of these drive-in church services, and that courts are saying that in some cases that that's allowed. I think that where I first recently heard about the drive-in church service was a news story that came across when the Department of Justice filed what's called a statement of interest in a case in Mississippi, in the town of Greenville, Mississippi. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Holly, being from Mississippi? Sure. Okay. Well, the people in Greenville, I guess, had originally said that they could not have drive-in church services, even though they continued to have things like drive-in restaurants, and people would go and pick up their food that way. And there was a legal challenge there, also from a Baptist church. And the Department of Justice filed a statement of interest there. It came across the news program that I watch each night with my husband. We watch it on tape. And I remember when I heard it, I said, wait, pause. I want to talk about this with you. Okay, let's think through this. What's the problem with the drive-in church?
Right.
And I think that's the reaction we're seeing from a lot of people, that seems, on at least at first glance, to solve the social distancing problem that we're having.
Yeah, it's a creative way for religious gatherings to occur. We know that primarily the focus has been on having online services, different ways that you can worship together at home. But this is another creative way, is to all be in the parking lot with your windows rolled up, or, you know, however, there's a lot of different ways to do it. Because sometimes I've heard listening on the radio together, or they might have the service somehow outside, but apart from the cars. And yes, what we're talking about, the enforcement of these orders will be different when you're talking about different things, talking about a drive-in service in your cars versus a typical gathering where you're together. I thought what was interesting about the DOJ position, as they intervened in that Mississippi case, the statement that they put out was making a general religious liberty point, but it seemed kind of overstated, because it said that the government may not impose special restrictions on religious activity that do not apply to similar non-religious activity. That sounds a lot like what I said just a few minutes ago. It's true. Of course, the government cannot impose special restrictions on religious activity that don't apply to other similar non-religious activity. But then they say, for example, if a government allows movie theaters, restaurants, concert halls, and other comparable places of assembly to remain open and unrestricted, it may not order houses of worship to close or limit their size or otherwise impede religious gatherings. Religious institutions must not be singled out for special burdens. Well, again, I would say, of course. And I was just scratching my head, being from Mississippi, not being able to imagine any kind of situation where the movie theaters are open and the churches are closed. And in fact, that's not what was going on there.
Right. Instead, they had what they call, you know, drive-in or drive-through establishments that, for health and safety and convenience, that people can pick up curbside what they might have otherwise usually gone in to the establishment to get. And I think we could have a longer conversation about the difference in those two things. And is a drive-in service more akin to a mass gathering of cars, or is it more akin to driving through to pick up your food or your prescriptions from the pharmacy?
Right.
And I think that nuance is lost, and is certainly lost in that quote that you read from the Department of Justice's statement of interest.
Well, another thing before we leave that point about kinds of enforcement and what it looks like to, you know, enforce government orders against churches that are, you know, gathering for religious reasons, is that while we might say that we are safer in our cars, and of course that makes intuitive sense to us, if you have a large gathering of cars for some kind of religious worship, you know, it may not be quite as simple as we're imagining, because if the the weather changes and people start wanting to get out of their cars, or if you're in there a long time, somebody's going to need to go to the bathroom. And, you know, is the church open? Can you go in? But, you know, just carefully, one at a time. I mean, it is not just a simple solution. And I think we're going to be learning in the next few weeks as people come up with more creative ideas and as government tries to accommodate these situations, we're going to figure out what we can and should do. I think the last thing we want to talk about today is that important principle that religious gatherings can't be treated differently than secular gatherings. We saw a provocative title in an op-ed this week that said, if liquor stores are essential, why isn't church? And I think I have been part of a conversation discussion with a little less inflammatory title that says, does the Constitution require a state to treat worship services like a grocery store? These questions make sense as you're trying to analyze the religious liberty issues that have been arising. When I see these kinds of headlines, I know that the first thing I have to do is look at the laws or the orders that they're talking about. And are we treating apples like apples and oranges like oranges? And as we started talking about a while ago, some of these orders are about mass gatherings, and mass gatherings that include sporting events and concerts and religious services all deal with the threat that you're going to have a lot of people close together for a long period of time. That threat is different from the general threat that we all know exists the more you're outside of your house and there's a chance that you're going to be exposed to the virus. And so I think that we're seeing that most of the cases, when the courts look at these things, they can justify treating churches like other mass gatherings, even though there are other settings where it appears people have quite a bit of freedom, and there might be large numbers of people in a place, such as a big box store or a large grocery store. And these cases are mostly coming out with upholding the government orders, making these distinctions between mass gatherings and other kinds of activity, because the two aren't posing the same threat.
Yeah. And having looked at a few of these, and I know you have as well, Holly, and I want to hear more in detail about how some of those cases are coming down. But again, just how hyper-local each of these cases are. And sometimes in most cases, we have, you know, a series of executive orders that come out because we have evolving information about the virus. We also have different communities having peaks at different times. And so we'll see, you know, how the government officials are responding there. And yeah, those titles are provocative for sure, but I've never been to a mass gathering in a grocery store or in a liquor store or in any of these other businesses that are open. And of course, those businesses are having to abide by all kinds of social distancing directives when you're in the store, you know, whether it's a place on the floor that tells you where to stand compared to the next person. We're not there to hear a concert or a sermon in the store. And if that was the case, then I think the plaintiffs would have a much stronger argument that they were being singled out unfairly in some way.
Yeah, I think in many of the cases, that distinction between mass gathering and other places where there might be a lot of people, you can usually see the logical difference. And sometimes it may be a problem of language. And we know that language is used loosely and differently in news stories and in advocacy papers and in actual court documents and government orders. And I say that because the order, for example, an order in Kansas that defines mass gatherings does so the way that I was talking about it, with movie theaters, museums, stadiums, arenas, these places, conference rooms, places where you have these gatherings, including religious facilities. And then in another part of the order, it says the following activities or facilities are exempt from the prohibitions of this order. Well, then these exemptions aren't mass gatherings. These are just, again, things that are protected. In some states, they might be referred to as essential services. But again, language matters. And in this situation, there's a list of places and activities, I guess facilities and activities that are allowed. And they include hospitals and National Guard facilities and retail stores, things that are necessary for ongoing operation of society or necessary to get what you need to make it through this virus. You know, you've got to be able to get your food. You've got to be able to get your medical services. And so those things are in a different category.
Yeah. So, you know, earlier we did say that for the most part, it looks like if a church is challenging one of these mass gathering bans as it applies to them, if they haven't been exempted in some way, that they're likely to lose that. And we saw that, for instance, this past week in New Mexico, right? Can you share a little bit about that case and what the court found there?
I can. And two things come to mind about that case. One, because it overlaps with the other case we're talking about. And people listening to this will have plenty of time to decide how many cases they want to know about. But hopefully this will be helpful for understanding the broad principles. The New Mexico case involved a church not just wanting an exemption from the mass gathering ban, but it wanted an exemption for its church operations, for its staff, because they needed 30 people, which was more than the allowed part of the order, to put on their worship service. Wow. Now they said, we can't get it done with the 5 or 10 minimum. You know, we need all members of the band or praise team or whatnot. And so that was kind of interesting to just see a different kind of claim that wasn't about the mass part, the people coming in, although that was one aspect of the case, but it was about how the staff put on the worship service. The other thing about the New Mexico case that it talked about that we were just touching on is these church claims where they want to be treated like other entities might say, hey, we can spread out. Just like when people are doing their shopping at the grocery store, the big box store, there can be a lot of people in there because there's a lot of square footage. And why can't we do that? You know, we can open our huge church facility and tell everybody to skip a pew or something like that. But the court rejected that. So the New Mexico case came out like the second Kentucky case you were talking about, where the court really said apples to apples, oranges to oranges, we're going to uphold this distinction and not grant the church this immediate relief. Now, there is something interesting about these cases in that they are rushed to the court for emergency relief, and they're seeking what's called a temporary restraining order. And even where you lose that, you kind of, your case might continue that, like when more facts are gathered, you might find a way to proceed and actually win later on. Again, that more time allows us to establish the facts and find out if there is any wrongful treatment of the church, any kind of religious targeting or unfair treatment. And that brings up the one case that I know about that has gone the other way, and it just came out. There is a Kansas case, for those who are following this stuff very closely. I have to say the second Kansas case, because there's at least been two cases coming out of the same Governor Kelly, I think her name is, order in Kansas. But this second decision looks very similar to the other cases that I read, and it just comes out differently. It comes out on the side of the church, and it really shows that someone can accept these arguments that where people are getting out and more freely operating with other people around, it sounds like the government doesn't have the highest interest in not letting more than 10 people be in a church. Okay, that's kind of how the thinking goes. Or like if the huge Walmart can have hundreds of people shopping, then shouldn't a religious huge mega church with the same square footage be able to have so many people there? And the church will say, oh, and we'll make sure that people keep their distance. And hey, we'll even make them put on hand sanitizer as they to wipe down with hand sanitizer as they come in, or put on gloves or something like that. And so some of these cases will proceed, and will be developed based upon whether the church really can make a strong claim that they're being treated unfavorably compared to other things that are going on in that jurisdiction. And I think the case, as I read it, looks wrong. It's not convincing to me. I do understand that where there's such a variety of orders that apply different ways, a smart lawyer can figure out how to find some argument to help your client, in this case, a church, make an argument that they shouldn't be closed down.
Yeah. And I think that we will continue to see cases like this as our society gradually opens up in different areas across the country, that while bans on mass gatherings remain in place, there will be attempts to try to open up houses of worship first among those.
I think that's true. And I think that we will keep learning more, and hopefully the information will be before the courts about what is medically necessary and what's happening and how this virus is continuing to spread, so that government can clearly make its case where it needs to for the protection of all its people. And we will take hope in the fact that most people, including these large religious groups, will want to do the right thing. They will find other ways to gather and follow the government's instructions and orders without, you know, losing all of their religious opportunities.
That's right. Well, with that tour of the cases that we've seen in courts around the country, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about where we've seen religion respected in our world this week.
Okay, we are back for our last segment of Respecting Religion, where we like to talk about the ways that we see religion talked about or referenced in society around us. And when we started this, we thought we'd be talking about all the books we're reading and movies we're seeing. I thought I'd be going to the drive-in. I'm just kidding. But actually, I'm still finding that most of what I learn about religion and see religion around me is through my news sources, occasionally on a podcast, but mostly it's in my review of the national papers and sometimes social media. And I am enjoying continuing to learn about different perspectives. I saw that this past week that you could also learn about atheism and humanism, in that our friends at the American Humanist Association hosted an Ask an Atheist Day. I thought that was interesting, to create a forum where people can ask questions about atheism or humanism. In fact, it was actually a forum with a humanist chaplain who I think is a friend of AHA's. He's a chaplain at Harvard University, which was just a reminder of the great diversity of religion and how that flourishes in America. And at Harvard University, there is a whole group of chaplains from all different religious perspectives, including humanism. So there was a forum with that chaplain talking, taking questions, not just about humanism, but in particularly kind of guidance as people are getting through these weeks.
Yeah. Well, I think we approach this segment in a similar way this week. I am also reading a lot of news, and we've been talking about holidays recently and big religious holidays. And this week is the start of the month-long holiday of Ramadan. And there was a really good piece from Religion News Service, Aisha Khan, about something called the Muslim Prisoner Project. And one impact of COVID-19 on the prison population is family visits have been severely limited or stopped altogether during this time to help prevent the spread of the virus. And this article talked about the response from this Muslim Prisoner Project for children in particular. And at the end of Ramadan, there's a feast of Eid, and one aspect of that is giving gifts to children. And so kind of building on the model of the Angel Tree Project, Angel Tree is a Christian ministry that helps collect presents at Christmas time for the children of incarcerated parents. And so building on that model, they're raising money to buy presents for children for Eid to make sure that they knew that their parents still cared for them and were concerned about them during this time that they can't be physically present with each other, even on a very nice. Limited basis. Yeah, it was a good story. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Sounds good. And we'll keep our eyes and ears open.
Well, that brings us to the close of this episode of Respecting Religion. This is the 10th episode in our series, and we want to thank you for inviting us into your home or earbuds as we continue our time of social distancing. For more details on what we discussed today, including links to the articles we mentioned, check out the show notes that go with the episode.
Tune in on next Thursday for our next episode in this podcast series. You can see a list of all the episodes on our website. Visit bjconline.org/respectingreligion. And subscribe to the BJC podcast so you don't miss an episode. We're on all the major platforms.
Let us know what you think of the podcast on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill. And you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC. And get to know BJC. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we've been working for faith freedom for all since 1936.
Join us again next week for a new conversation, Respecting Religion.